to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois at the Reformed Forum HQ. And I have with me some exciting panelists. We're going to talk about some exciting things and have the right people to do it. I want to introduce first, of course, one of our co-founders, Jeff Waddington, who's pastor of Faith OPC in Fawn Grove, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff, how's it going?
Oh, doing well. Thank you for asking, Camden. Glad to be back on the program to talk about Peter van Maastricht.
Yes, we're going to talk about van Maastricht in the series Theoretical Practical Theology today, Volume 3. We also have someone who just were speaking in advance of starting the recording, who has made it into the footnotes. And he's still with us. There are a lot of footnotes, I'm sure, of people that are no longer with us. We have Pastor Dan Ragusa. Of course, Dan is a pastor of Messiah's Reformed Fellowship out in New York City. It's a URCNA congregation. And he's also a graduate of Mid-America Reformed Seminary. That's where I first met him. And then he went off and began his PhD studies at Westminster Theological Seminary. And we've had him on the program many times. So thanks for joining us, Dan. It's good to see you today.
Yeah, great to be here, Camden. Thanks for the invite.
You bet. And today you're dialing in from Texas, you mentioned. That's so right. You're in the neighborhood of some of our other contributors, at least state-wise or state-nation-wise. And glad to have you with us. When are you heading back to New York, to your homeland?
Yeah, we're heading back on Saturday. So we're just visiting my wife's family down here. And I mentioned earlier this map. Was given to my in-laws by their children, and they had been missionaries really throughout the world, in the Philippines, in Japan, in Singapore, in Hungary. And so when they came back to the States, they gave them this, and they had this whole pins everywhere where they lived.
That's exciting. Do you mind saying what theological tradition, or with whom were they ministering, especially in Philippines?
Yeah, so they were not part of a Reformed missionary group, but they were with CREW. Some people are familiar with them. I think CREW also they've recently left CREW for a number of reasons, which might be a longer discussion to get into.
Different episode, different podcast.
Totally different episode.
Yeah, very not different. This one. Although I might know why, but that's another.
We have my brother and sister-in-law were for many years involved in Campus Crusade for Christ, and then they were there while it rebranded to CREW. And my wife, Erica, went on several summer projects. And that's where I met my wife at Campus Crusade for Christ at Bradley University back in 2001. So I'm deeply indebted and thankful to the ministry there and the ways in which the Lord has used that organization. The reason I asked, Dan, wouldn't have been too much of a long shot, though, with you being a URC guy. I don't know your wife's history or your in-law's history, but I was talking to Doug Clawson and asking, you know, we're just speaking about the different students that we have at Reformed Academy, which is our outlet for our online video courses, which we make for free and translate into a variety of languages. But we have one of the highest concentrations of students outside of course, the United States or Canada or Great Britain and all that is Philippines. Which is really interesting. And I was asking Doug, just ruminating, he's the head of foreign missions for the OPC, the general secretary for foreign missions. And he told me that for many years, there was a URCNA mission field in the Philippines. So he wasn't too surprised by this to think that there was at least a seedbed of Reformed theology in Philippines, and that had, you know, perhaps endured for the last 40 or 50 years. I don't know if there's a mission there now, but I pray and hope that there's a Reformed church there. So maybe we'll get some emails or some people can write in and explain to us the history of the Reformed church in Philippines and how these video courses are connecting with folks. It's really exciting.
Yeah.
That's great. I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad you have that missions connection too. So, but today we're speaking about the works of God and the fall of man. We have volume 3 of Petrus van Maastricht's Theoretical Practical Theology. It's translated by Todd Rester. We've had on the program before to speak about this, but it's also here listed, edited by Joel Beakey. It's published by Reformation Heritage Books. We're exceedingly thankful to them for all that they do and for sending the office a copy here that I have in my hands. And I've got volume 1 over there to my left, and then behind me, Way there. There's volume two. So I've got them all around me. I'm entirely encompassed by, and once all the other copies come out, we'll be fully surrounded by the Van Maastricht series. Jeff, you were mentioning that, why don't you tell us a bit about your experience with a previous edition of this work? And you were saying we're expecting seven of these, right?
Yeah, seven volumes when it's completed. That's the expected number of. Now you see the first volume is relatively thin, then it gets bigger, and this is the third. I don't know if that portends for the future that each volume will be thicker than the last.
It's like the Hughes Oliphant old series, which
preaching series.
It's like the Fibonacci numbers in terms of the width of the volumes.
So I was telling Camden before we started recording that I was at Princeton Seminary Speer Library back several years ago now. And I was in the rare book room archives area. And I was there with a friend to actually look at Benjamin Warfield's personal scrapbooks. But in the room where we sat down at the table to examine the scrapbooks, there on the table was a copy of the Latin version of the Theoretica Practica Theologia in a nice, beautiful white leather bound, and it was about yay thick. It was, as I understand it, at least at the time of Jonathan Edwards, there were two ways you would find it on the market. One was a single volume, like I saw, and then there was a two volume edition. I don't know. That's the Latin, and then there was what, only two Latin editions, if I remember correctly. So that's probably the edition that I saw. I wasn't smart enough to like take a picture of the title page with my camera. That would have been the smart thing to do. But anyway, so I had the privilege of holding in my hand at least 18th century edition of the full text.
It's just hard to imagine minuscule. Having something that large in one codex. It was a codex, right?
Yep.
That's crazy. Yeah. Dan, what's been your experience?
I've really just gotten to know Patrice Van Maastricht through these translated volumes. But I'd also, while I was taking a course out at Puritan for the doctoral program at Westminster, taking one of my external courses there. And I took a really great class with Dr. Adrian Neely on the Nader Reformati. And he ended up suggesting that I write a paper on this small work that Maastricht had written in Latin against Balthasar Becker, who we'll probably talk about a little bit later.
Yeah.
And he provides a critique of that. And so ended up working through very slowly and maybe inadequately, but tried my best to work through the Latin of that text. And I wrote a paper on that. And so then right shortly after that, all of a sudden his works are starting to come out and be published. And been really enjoying that. Jeff, you had mentioned you had seen, I guess, the first edition of 1682, because I think in this volume they mentioned the second edition came out 1698.
Correct.
And I'm curious how much it was expanded upon, because between that time is when Balthasar Becker wrote his really influential work, I'm going blank on the name. Was it the Disenchanted World?
Oh, the World Bewitched. The World Bewitched.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, the English. It was in Latin or Dutch or both.
The Abitur Verite Vereld?
I think.
I don't know Dutch.
A fair bit of that. It was the Vereld. As I understand it, some of the, not necessarily the whole book, but some of it would have filtered into the second edition of the TPT, as mm-hmm. As it's called, right? Clearly, Van Maastricht carries forward his critique of Cartesian philosophy, right? And that's partially in the background or in the foreground. The mind-body dualism of Descartes feeds into the the rejection of belief in demons, things of that. Maybe it just as a matter of the context in which they were living, people just stopped believing. It wasn't because they necessarily read solid arguments to critique certain, you know, belief in spirits or demons, etc. But they now take the skeptical attitude, which of course is methodological doubt, which mm-hmm. is something that Descartes pioneered or championed, I guess would be the better word, right? And he's going to be Van Maastricht will be one of the guys who's critical of the Cartesian philosophy and its infiltration into the church. Unfortunately, from what I understand, it did infiltrate the church and leads to basically the downfall of Reformed scholasticism, or contributes to the fall from the height of high orthodoxy. And even Francis Turretin's son, Jean-Alphonse, right, is Turretin, in his own writing, manifests that declension, at least that's from what my own reading has suggested.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. Balthasar Becker himself was a Dutch Reformed minister before he was deposed. Right. So he was within the Reformed Church, and that's where it's quite difficult, because they're using a lot of Reformed terminology in a somewhat deceptive way to promote skepticism, to push this Cartesian thinking into the Reformed theology. And something along those lines that's probably interesting to focus on is in this volume, it's some 600 pages almost, I think. He spends quite a bit of time talking about angels and demons, and it's kind of odd. And if you were to read, for example, the Belgic Confession on the Doctrine of Creation as well, there's a long section on angels and demons, relatively long considering for a confession. And this doctrine, though, really seemed to be a kind of touchstone, especially coming out of the Reformation and into this new period, where whether or not somebody's going to uphold sola scriptura and maintain the proper relationship between theology and philosophy, faith and reason. And so I think a lot of these discussions, especially Maastricht's discussion on angels and demons, is really getting at that relationship and the inability to affirm that demons or spirits can interact with bodies. Again, was a kind of touchstone to see whether or not somebody has upheld scripture as their highest authority and made philosophy a kind of handmaid into it, or if philosophy has come to stand over theology. And so I think that reflects why Maastricht spends so much time discussing those two things.
Yeah, there's a tendency among the Orthodox to sit loosely on commitment to be given a certain philosophical school, right? There's a eclecticism, if you will. If something is helpful, you take it and use it. There's more to it to be said than that, right? But it's Augustine's teaching on the plundering of the Egyptians, no doubt, is in the background, either in the near background or far background. But it's really clear that there's no commitment to there's no commitment to a Cartesian school. There's an analysis, and if there's something worth using, you may. And this comes up in the discussion in the introduction by the translator Todd Rester and the editor Joel Beakey about the four unique aspects of this volume that makes it differ, say, from other theologies from the same era. Of course, they don't mention Cartesianism per se, or anti-Cartesianism per se, because that's already been discussed in previous volumes. So we're made aware, we're sensitized to the fact that Van Maastricht is very critical. And it's not clear to me that he might have been in the minority, even in his whole career, because at one point, a faculty member who was pro Descartes is hired, and Van Maastricht is told to keep his mouth shut, basically, to be a nice guy. Yeah. And apparently he was, although he never gave up his critique of Cartesianism as a system. Yeah. But there are the four elements, and the first one is escaping me, but there's he rejects Copernicus, interestingly enough. Defense of, as we've already said, demons and angels. I will just do this because I'm an old man, right? But in the, we'll find it here, right? The a mediating lapsarian position, that is, he is somewhere between supra and infra lapsarianism, or what was called sublapsarianism in an earlier era. Then there's a fair bit of discussion given to that. Then the rejection of Copernicanism, and we'll go back to these. Defense of the reality of demons and magic, although I think we probably discussed that sufficiently. But although I would say, if someone were to force me to the wall and say, what weakness do Reformed people have now? That might be the underplaying of active satanic activity, because we're afraid of, you know, what we see in other traditions where they go overboard in the opposite direction. Then his discussion of the third heaven.
Right. Those are the four major issues. Yeah, those are the four
issues that is listed in the preface to the volume. So Dan, with regard to the first point, because I'm reading it and I'm going, okay, he's, I don't want to say hair splitting, because that's a pejorative, right?
Yeah.
That he's nuancing the differences between supra and infralapsarianism, and he's taking, it's not what I would call a middle path all the time. What it is, he's adding some further refinement. In one instance on the decrees, right? And then he makes a distinction between predestination on the one hand and election and reprobation on the other hand. So if you want to kind of,
maybe we can start with the Belgic, Dan. I mean, you're the one here that confesses the Belgic.
That's right. <true. laughs>
I affirm them as part of my involvement on the board of Mid-America. I also fully affirm the three forms of unity, though I am, if you cut me open, I'm bleed Presbyterian. But tell us a little bit about these confessional views on infra and supralapsarianism, and then maybe where Van Maastricht kind of colors and shades in a little bit differently, or I should say maybe even in addition.
Yeah. So the Belgic Confession holds to a pretty strong infralapsarian position. It says, I don't have it in front of me and don't have it memorized off the top of my head here, but basically that God elects out of the mass of fallen humanity, right? And so within the order of decrees, God ordains the fall, and out of that fall, he elects a people in which he will save. And Maastricht, though, as Jeff was getting at, provides a kind of mediating position between the infralapsarian position and the supralapsarian position. And for Maastricht, he still maintains that that adage, that, what is it, like, last in execution is first.
Yeah, the last in execution is first is in intention, or the vice versa. First in intention is last in execution.
Right. And so what that leads them to do then is to put up front God's intention to glorify himself. And so even really throughout this whole volume, everything is brought back to the glory of God, which is really significant, I think, in light of Maastricht's own tradition, the canons of Dort, for example, when it talks about the proper teaching of election, To avoid this speculation and to avoid, you know, going down these holes that leads to doubt and people becoming uncertain about their own salvation and election. The canons of Dort say that election is taught properly for the sake of God's glory and for the comfort of God's people. And so it really puts some guardrails around the teaching of this doctrine. I think Maastricht maintains them. And so throughout this volume, here, he's focused upon the glory of God. And that's his starting point. His starting point, which begins to modify the infralapsarian position, is God's decree, God's desire to manifest his glory in saving some and condemning others. This focus on the glory of God begins to kind of move him slightly away from the infralapsarian, or at least modify it in some capacity. I know that editors of the volume were wondering whether Maastricht was moving from a supralapsarian position to now modify that to, you know, move towards the infra, or if he began with the infra and moving more towards the supra position. To be honest, I'm not really conclusive on it. I'm not sure which direction he was moving in. But they do provide a helpful summary in terms of the four decrees and or the ordering of them. So if I could just read them, that might be helpful for the listeners and for us even just to have in front of us.
Sure.
So in the summary, it begins firstly, the first ordered decree is to manifest God's glory of mercy on some indefinite persons capable of being created and his punishing righteousness on others. Second, that individuals would be created and fall into sin. Third, the election and reprobation of these fallen individuals. And four, a preparing and directing the means to fulfill or accomplish the destiny of elect and reprobate individuals. So you still have the act of election and reprobation coming after, or the decree rather, coming after the fall, but you have this intention prefaced before the fall in terms of God's desire to glorify himself. And one more point that's interesting, again, the editors draw attention to this, is Gerhardus Voss's critique of this this ordering of Maastricht. His basic critique is to say that by prefacing it with just this more abstract desire of God to glorify himself in some indefinite people, makes the decree impersonal, right. Which I think, you know, the Belgic is trying to guard against, and the infralapsarian position is trying to guard against. It's God doesn't just elect and reprobate an undefined mass of or category of people, but it's personal. It's individual people elected, individual people reprobated. That's Voss's slight critique of Maastricht on this point. But yeah, he sees a lot of fighting, and I guess for him, he's trying to mediate it between the infra and the supra.
Now, he's apparently not alone in this mediating viewpoint. And it makes me, because there are scholars of Jonathan Edwards who say that he has this back and forth between the supra and infra, depending on the particular aspect of the decrees that you're looking at. And I'm wondering, because Van Maastricht is Edwards' favorite theologian, period, bar none, okay, including Turretin, who he holds in high regard, and including John Calvin. Van Maastricht is the go-to guy, the language we would use, right? So I wonder if some of that is influencing Edwards in his thinking on the subject. Something worth considering.
Are there folks working, or are you working, Jeff, on the kind of the conversation between Edwards and Van Maastricht? Is that something that we see in current literature?
I'm working on a book chapter, but it's with regard to the use of the Prisca Theologia, the primitive theology. So it's slightly different area, although everything overlaps everything, as you know, in ultimately at the end of the day. So, but yeah, definitely Edwards sees there are three references that Edwards makes to Van Maastricht in letters to Joseph Bellamy, I believe, or Samuel Hopkins, one or both. So I'm aware, there's one quote that's always referenced, but then there are two others where he points out that Van Maastricht is the best all around theologian. For controversies, of course, it would be Turretin. Although, having said that, and maybe this has been discussed in the past, the methodology of Van Maastricht is to go from the exegetical to the dogmatical to the electical and then finally to the practical. So almost every doctrine he's going to look at, every topic or loci,
right,
he's looking at is going to have those
forms.
Almost template. Every. I did notice that there were a few that didn't, that because it was still building off of an exegetical argument made in a previous point, he doesn't have the exegetical, but that's just in a few instances. But that's his method. So he has a confrontational element, or we might call it an apologetic element, right? The electics, which means confrontation in the Greek, right? So that's the apologetic element. And he's living at a time, as did Edwards, where the Enlightenment is hot and heavy, right? Descartes being the obvious example, but also Leibniz, right? Mm-hmm. All these folks have moved from France or Germany to Holland because Holland is perceived to be tolerant, and so that's where they begin to publish a lot of their well-known sure. philosophical works. So anyway, so the first point is basically in-house theological among reform folk, right? The lapsarian issue. But the second one gets at an apologetic
rejection
issue
of Copernicanism,
right? The relationship of faith and science, or which is really a variation on faith and philosophy, right? Because for many, many years, science was a part of philosophy until it built up enough of its own discipline to become a separate thing. In its own right.
Let me read an excerpt here to get us started here on page 34, Roman numeral 34 of the preface. By 1588, the dominant model was a geocentrism introduced by Ptolemy and held by many people. But in 1543, the second generation of the Reformation, Copernicus published a groundbreaking work setting forth heliocentrism, which places the sun at the center of our solar system. By 1588, Tycho Brahe combined some of the geometric and computational advantages of Copernicus's insights with what he considered to be the philosophical advantages of the older Ptolemaic system, setting forth a geometric paradigm where the sun revolved around the earth, but the planets revolved around the sun. Between 1615 and 1621, Johannes Kepler published works refining the heliocentric model more accurately. Around the same time, Galileo, the father of modern physics, made astronomical discoveries that further chipped away at the older Ptolemaic system. The price he paid for those discoveries was coming under suspicion, and later, the condemnation of the Roman Inquisition. No one expects the Roman that's the Spanish Inquisition. René Descartes moved to the Netherlands, as you mentioned, Jeff, in 1628 and wrote all his major works there. And at one point, he proposed a heliocentric solar system. He also laid the groundwork for the development of calculus. So he's to blame for this requirement that I had to take in college. Just between the first and second editions of Maastricht's TPT, 1682 and 1698, this is really interesting. Isaac Newton published his Principia in 1687, which theoretically derived Kepler's three heliocentric laws of planetary motion, previously derived from empirical evidence with the newly invented calculus. Just one more sentence here. In the midst of this rising current, Maastricht argued strongly against heliocentrism, saying, quote, "The Reformed deny it in agreement with the Tychonian astronomers because divine revelation evidently denies it, and determines that the earth stands immovable." I'll stop there. That's pages 34 and 35 of the preface, volume 3 of Theoretical Practical Theology. That's in the preface there by Now, Todd Rester, I believe. So it's fascinating to think of the difference between the first and second editions and all of the Copernican revolutions.
Going on in between that time. My initial thought, and then I'll yield the floor to Daniel, but the I believe Luther and Calvin also rejected Copernicus. I'd have to, someone could check and put in the, you know, get back to us on that. But I'm so he's not alone in his rejection of Copernicus. And it's easy for us, of course, at this late stage to say it should have been obvious to everyone that Copernicus was right. Well, says who, right?
Yeah.
So, and one of the points that the editors make is that even though they and we may disagree with Van Maastricht's argument, the result of his argument, there might be things we can learn regarding the influence of philosophy on theology. Is philosophy a handmaiden, or is it a math taskmaster, right? And that's one of the issues that he's dealing with on this question. But he is not alone among the reformers or the reform scholastics to reject the issue, but it is a healthy dose of reality to us to see that someone who gets so much right on this particular issue, though he assesses it, it's not a knee-jerk reaction. He, among other things, he says that it doesn't square with the teaching of Scripture.
Yeah.
Right. Go ahead, Daniel. You look like that's a good segue to hand off to you.
Yeah, no, that's helpful, Jeff. Keeping Maastricht's context in mind is helpful here, because it's not until, I think the preface even mentions this, until I think the 1720s, maybe 1727, that a stronger empirical proof is given for heliocentrism.
Right.
So Maastricht isn't dealing with those later proofs that we're more familiar with today and live in light of. But he's dealing more with theoretical proofs, and in his mind, it's not as airtight of an argument that he's dealing with that we would think of today. But on the other hand, you also have these accommodation theories or accommodation methods of interpretation that were popular in his day. For example, we mentioned Balthasar Becker before, and he employs that as well. Where basically the idea is not that God accommodates himself in, you know, as we would understand in terms of condescending to us, as Calvin mm-hmm. says, lisping to us like a nurse, nurse lisp to a baby or something along those lines, but that God would accommodate himself to the errors of mankind. And so in many ways, this heliocentric theory was being used to further that biblical interpretation method. And so I think that all made Maastricht, you read some of his statements, he's very vehement and strong in denouncing heliocentrism. And I think that context really, kind of explains the reasoning for that. And it's really, again, his desire to maintain the authority of Scripture in all things as the queen of the sciences.
No, it's possible, at least in our day, at least for me, if there's not enough, if the scriptures are clear, or at least with something like the Copernican Revolution, would it have been possible, given the context, for him to take a let's wait and see approach? Or was it the context so battle-driven, apologetically, if you will, that just was not a realistic option. You couldn't say let's hold off on this until we get further data. He actually believed that empirically the Copernican Revolution was wrong. Right. Mm-hmm. It's, as you point out, it's 21 years after he's dead. He dies in 1706. Mm-hmm. It's many years after he's gone to be with the Lord that firmer, right, we would say firmer proofs are discovered to ground our acceptance of a heliocentric or sun-centered universe. Mm-hmm. But this is really the same kind of argument as the one about demons, and it's again that philosophy, the relationship of non-biblical, or not unbiblical, but non-biblical thought is over against biblical revelation. Mm-hmm. And how do you relate the two? And I don't think I can fault him for his method. In other words, I think with regard to Copernicus, it's the historical location that he's in. Mm-hmm. It's providentially placed at a point in time where the evidence was not all in. And he wasn't willing to accept highly speculative, theoretical arguments about, I'm trying to remember, and maybe neither of you know this off the top of your heads, but what wasn't the early arguments based upon the effects in space and time and space, that there were extrapolations as to how things had to be in the background in order to create the effects that we were seeing?
I don't know. That's interesting. I don't know.
I'm pretty sure that's how the argument was initially put forward, and that may be what Van Maastricht is reacting to.
Yeah.
The fourth unique aspect of this volume is Van Maastricht's third heaven doctrine, mm-hmm. which, by the way, puts me in mind of Voss and Klein and some guy that lives on Bickford Street in the Glenside.
Bickley.
I got that wrong. Bickford. That's a barbecue pit. No. Because the third heaven, there's the first heaven as would be the sky. Then the second heaven would be outer space, as we would call it. And then the third heaven would be the created place where God dwells with the saints and the angels.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's no harder than that. But where the issue gets debated, and we ought to relate to this because it's kind of has been repeated down through the years. Hmm. There was a strong movement to say that the resurrected saints would live on the new earth, and that the angels would live in heaven with God. And Van Maastricht is saying, no, the third heaven is where the saints and the angels live with God, and the earth, the rejuvenated earth, would be a museum. Is that the language I think he uses? It would be a thing for us to look at and be amazed by God's power and glory and grace. So, and the reason why I say it reminds me of Voss and Klein and Tipton is that it's the concern is the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The concern is the same, the heavenly mindedness, to use Paul's language, right?
Right.
It's to be, it's not to get, how shall I put it without being somewhat critical, but the disciples of Abraham Kuyper tend to be earthly oriented. At least in this, in the larger scheme of things, mm-hmm. whereas someone like Voss, and probably the offsiding heritage that he inherited, was more pietistic in a good sense, more concerned with preparing ourselves to live with the Lord in heaven, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so. That's the dispute that Van Maastricht is dealing with. He's taking the side of Paul. He's taking the side of Voss, even though Voss comes after him. Mm-hmm. We're destroying all sense of chronology here. He's taking the side of Tipton and Klein. But, you know, in other words, the eschatological nature of salvation, mm-hmm. right? Is really what I'm saying.
Sure.
And he doesn't use that language, although I think that's behind what he's defending, the third heaven.
Yeah, on page 40, I think 45, I gotta get. We're starting to get into the upper numbers here, the Roman numerals. Where I'm not too sharp. I think the only time I've seen that number is one year in a Super Bowl, maybe. I don't know, but the top of that, yeah, 45, I think. In volume 6, Maastricht will discuss. So he's talking about the 6th volume, which isn't out yet. Will come out. So I look forward to that, because in volume 6, Maastricht will discuss the renovation by fire of the heavens and the earth. The heavens in this phrase for the Reformed of the 17th century referred only to the lower first and possibly second heavens. For as one scholar of 17th century eschatology noted, no one believed the imperial, so it's E-M-P-Y-R-E-A-L, heaven would undergo a cleansing fire, since it was the abode of Christ, the saints, and angels. What then would be the purpose of the new heavens and the new earth, if not to dwell in them? While the Reformed were cautious not to speak beyond what Scripture reveals, they understood that God certainly will have a purpose for the new heavens and the new earth, and often conjectured that they may serve as monuments of his former power, wisdom, and goodness towards man. So, and he continues, I'd be curious to know, in volume 6, we'll maybe revisit with another episode, but I'd be curious to know how he understands the descending of the new heavens and the new earth. Because it's not, in my eschatology, not that that matters, but my understanding of this is that the new heavens and the new earth would descend, and then there would be this renewal by fire where everything that does not persist would be burned up in a consuming fire, and everything that does persist, everything of the new creation, would in a sense be merged with or whatnot with the new heavens and the new earth, the new Jerusalem that descends. So I wouldn't retain the present visible earth as an enduring, existent, post consummation, well, but we're saying the new heavens and the new earth is the same, will be the same locale as what we presently see, but it will be renewed, right? Mm-hmm.
That seems to be what others in the Reformed community were saying, but sure. not Van Maastricht,
right? Which is what I'm saying. I'm interested. Right. I'm anticipating.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how he deals with that. You know, what the flesh he puts on the bones, right? Mm-hmm. When we get to that volume. Now, it may be a bit confusing, Camden, because 6 may not correspond to volume 6 of the English translation.
You. Good point.
Because he had volume numbers or section numbers. But it may be volume 6 as it comes out in our edition. So that'll be several years off.
Yeah, I believe volume 6 should deal with the covenants, the covenant of grace and its various administrations, which would probably culminate in something along those lines of the new heavens and the new earth.
Have you brothers read or at least perused the section on the covenant of nature or the covenant of works in this volume? I was only to read a bit of it. I haven't read as much as I would like, but it seemed really solid so far and thorough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's proof that covenant theology is not a British only, English, Scotch, Irish thing. It's actually across the Reformed.
Dan, do you feel vindicated for all those people that say, you know, only the Westminster standards have it really worked out, and the three forms don't have enough specific information there, so that leads to a whole breadth of odd views on certain things.
Yeah, no, very, very vindicated here.
It's a pretty long section, isn't it? Nature.
He says
nature.
He uses both terms, but
interchangeably. So I just found it fascinating as I was looking over that section to see how clearly it is explained.
Yeah, one interesting point in the covenant of nature chapter, like Turretin, he affirms the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil as two sacraments of the covenant. And he rejects, though, that I guess there were these views being put forward that paradise or the garden itself was a sacrament, in that it pointed to heaven. And so there was this heavenly downshadowing in the garden in some sense. So he doesn't use that language. But he rejects that as a sacrament. And then also the Sabbath. He says some people were viewing the Sabbath as a sacrament, which he also rejects in terms of a sacrament, even though it still points to our heavenly rest in the Empyrean heavens. with God to dwell with him. But what was interesting was that he didn't come down conclusively on whether a higher escalated life was offered to Adam in the beginning. He affirms
the deeper Protestant life. Conception.
What was that?
That's what Voss would call the deeper Protestant conception. The question is whether
which
that's
is interesting.
Right.
He says basically perhaps that's the case. But he wouldn't come down dogmatically on the point, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, I don't know. It's hard because later points almost seems to suggest that he does affirm it, but he explicitly says that he's not sure. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I need to revisit that. It's good material. But it's also be interesting and worthwhile to compare and contrast. Someone could write a paper on this if they're not already. Van Maastricht compared with Turretin, compared with Voss, and perhaps others on this specific question of the tree of life and the nature of the fellowship Adam had with the Lord before the fall into sin, and also the nature of the promise in the garden attached to the words of the covenant of works in Genesis 2:16-17. That'd be a great paper.
It would
dissertation.
No, I would suspect that he does affirm it, but maybe not with the intensity that we would like him to, because of his view of the third heaven that we've just talked about, right? So, because he views because he has a heavenly orientation, so he may have all the pieces, but he hasn't put them together in the way that Voss did.
Well, that's what I was saying, right? He's very adamant about the fact that man will dwell with God in the third heavens. And it's there that God invites him to share in his glory and to enjoy his glory. But then to deny that the tree of life, signified and sealed a higher escalated heavenly life, he doesn't make that point.
Jeff, do you have any suspicion or insider info on Edwards and his kind of view of the felix culpa? Is there anything like that in Van Maastricht? Maybe that might be another reason. This is just all speculation, but
yeah, I'm just following a hunch here, but given if there is a supralapsarian as well as an infralapsarian strain in Van Maastricht, then I can see him more readily accepting the idea of felix culpa. Although ultimately, any Reformed person who believes in the absolute sovereignty of God is going to have some notion of that.
Of course.
So I haven't looked at it, so I would have to give more. But this is the volume to look at, of course.
The basic gist, and for those who might not be following the arcane Latin terminology, would be a happy fall. So the idea that the fall into sin ends up bringing about, through the work of Christ, a greater glorification of the Lord than would have happened otherwise. This is hypothetical, of course, and it gets very complicated when we are speaking also about infra and superlapsarianism, the logical perspective on something that is eternal and ahistorical. Nevertheless, the question would be, what would have been man's end, hypothetically speaking, if Adam would have obeyed? And would that have been as glorious than what actually happened in history and what was decreed to happen in history? Was that mankind would fall into sin, but yet Christ would die and be raised from the dead to save the elect and to be glorified in and through them, through their lives, as Christ is glorified through this wonderful work. So that's the question. I'd be interested to know if any of Edwards' thoughts on this are coming from seeds found in Van Maastricht, given that he was his favorite theologian, or
That is a very good question. I don't know Van Maastricht well enough off the top of my head to answer that. But again, this is a volume to look at, creation and fall. So this is the one to consider, because he's the
Maybe
first
I should
section
have read the book.
Of the book
is,
yeah. The first section of the book is on the ordering of the decrees, right? We've already talked about the unique aspects of Van Maastricht's view of the decrees. So that would be one place to look. But certainly, if he didn't see the life, confirmed righteousness being offered to Adam for obedience to the prohibition, then that would seem to fit better with a scheme where one can come to faith in Christ and lose your salvation later on. Because Adam and Eve are obedient in the garden, and then they have to be perpetually obedient, in a sense, be under a, not perpetually obedient in the way that we all should be obedient to God, but under a perpetual
just never test. Confirmed. Yeah.
Right. They're never confirmed. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, now maybe Van Maastricht has an answer to that. To that question, but and of course, historically speaking, this is, he dies in 1706. So he's a teenager when the Westminster Assembly meets, right? He's born in 1630, so he's 13 years old when the West. So I was about to say they're contemporaries. Well, that's true, but. It wasn't like he was ministering at that point.
Has he been painted into that famous painting yet? There's some folks in there. Is he like in the window or something?
I'll have to go looking at it. On the back side, I have the names of all the people in the painting. Very unhistorical.
Sure.
Go ahead, Dan. Oh, just a quick quote, if anybody's interested in pursuing this further, from page 381. Just one sentence. Maastricht says, but whether this promised life after obedience would have been conferred in a terrestrial paradise or after a certain delay of time in paradise, in the heavenly paradise, and man transferred to heaven, scripture is silent. Although to Calvin, this seems extremely probable, end quote there.
This is where you get the, this is why I like the exegesis of Revelation 2 and 22 and seeing the symbolism. I think the answer to the question is held in the symbolism of the tree of life and the fact that the tree of life returns, but in amplified and greater and more significant form in Revelation.
We don't think it's as silent as he did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we also stand on the, you know, from the vantage point of having hundreds and maybe thousands of solid Reformed people reflecting on this for a couple centuries.
Right. He's still relatively, you know, the first 150 years of the Reformed faith. So he's still, you know, we're in the shadows. I realize in terms of accomplishment, we didn't mention it, but he was an accomplished Hebraist in his day. A Christian Hebraist. He was we think nowadays Greek and Hebrew, Aramaic, this is a matter of course, you learn them. But back in his day, Greek, that would have been true in Latin, but Hebrew and Aramaic, not as much. I mean, that does come about through the humanist movement, Renaissance, and it comes through in the Reformation. But he knew not only Hebrew and Aramaic, it's quite possible that he knew some cognate languages, and he was at home with rabbis, rabbinical studies, the Kabbalah, etc. So, I mean, this is the day before the partitioning of theology from biblical studies in the way that we have them now. So, but anyways, he was actually a professor of Hebrew.
And theology at Duisburg in 1669. Yeah. He was a pastor there. He served as professor of Hebrew and theology at the university from 1670 to 1677. But then he went and succeeded Fuchsius at Utrecht in 1677. So a lot going on.
Yeah, he taught at Hamburg on the Rhine before that. So he taught at three universities as well as being a pastor. Never married, by the way. Mm. It was 76 when he died. 76 when he died.
Dan, do you have any, or Jeff, any outstanding questions regarding this volume? Anything that you're excited to dive into or consider more, or not, maybe not even volume three, but in the future volumes? What could we anticipate, or what are you excited about?
Go ahead, Dan.
Sure. One thing that I would love to continue to look into is his use of the phrase "right reason."
Oh, and goodness.
All throughout. And I think it's a bit more nuanced than, and not that I've read everything on this at all. I mean, there's so much to read on it. So I don't want to make too much of a generalization, but I do wonder if there's more nuance to what he's talking about regarding reason, specifically as it functions within a theological system. Maastricht, this whole first part, including the, you know, this volume here, but really the whole first eight books of his theoretical practical theology, he defines that first part as faith, and faith functions as the entrance or gateway into doing theology. So it's just interesting to hear him use the phrase "right reason," and thinking about its relationship to faith. Even at times when he speaks of reason, and then he'll say reason, you know, affirms this in this way, but then he'll argue on the basis of the attributes of God, and it's like, well, you know, where he's reasoning on the basis of what has been revealed already. So thinking about the relationship further, I think there's a lot more to it, and he uses that phrase all throughout this volume here. Mm-hmm.
I wonder, because the I forget who the scholar was, but there was a scholar who traced out two different streams of right reason language, and one was a Thomistic and one was a non-Thomistic, and the non-Thomistic right reason is regenerate reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing that came to mind, I was reading it, was it almost seemed as if at times, so I don't know if this would work every time, but at times it almost seemed like right reason was almost equivalent to a good and necessary consequence. Mm. So I don't know if there's anything to that.
What you're getting at, Dan, is that the line crossed between reality as it is and how God made the human mind to function in the world that he created. And so right reason can be referred to reason as it was intended to function.
Yeah.
Not reason as autonomous reason as it in fact does function. That is fallen autonomous reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes there's a bleeding between regenerate reason and reason as it was created to function. Yeah. And of course, he would say regenerate reason is restored reason, right? Mm-hmm. So he might say, well, yeah, there's a bleeding between the two because that's the way God intended it to be.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, in this volume in particular, I wanted to look at how he handles image of God and the faculties, because I think he's a strong influence on Edwards in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see if I can detect any differences or if the commonality is such that we can trace things through him.
Mm-hmm.
Again, he's Edwards's favorite theologian, according to his own words. And more the go-to guy, even more than Calvin.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, what I've read is very intriguing.
Absolutely,
positively so. Right,
Jeff. Does this sound along Edwardsian line? Because I believe Maastricht was arguing against the Cartesians, who located judgment only in the will, so it's not in the intellect. And so Maastricht says that a judgment begins in the intellect and then can or cannot be worked out in the will or acted upon by the will.
Yeah, that's definitely the way Edwards would talk. He wouldn't want a blind will,
mm-hmm.
right? So if a judgment acting without the intellect is a non-starter for him.
Mm-hmm.
As I believe it should be for us. I don't think we do ourselves any benefit in overreacting to Thomistic intellectualism by responding with some sort of unthinking voluntarism, right? Where the will just does what it wants to do. Well, how does it do what it, how does it know what it wants to do if there's no intellect involved? You see how silly the discussion can get. I would say there are distinctions and nuances that perhaps we're not used to making in our day. And that's where reading someone like Van Maastricht or Turretin or Junius and the like, it forces us to remind ourselves that we actually have a heritage of dealing where we actually have the conceptual apparatus to deal with these issues. We simply forgot them because they weren't translated into modern languages with the rest of the theological heritage. And now that's being addressed. And now that's being addressed.
There's a lot to talk about. That's just in a hour long or so conversation about volume 3 here. You can see worlds of opportunity for scholars, both young and old, to consider further this book. So I want to thank Reformation Heritage Books again, but thank especially Van Maastricht himself, but then also Todd Rester for translating this and Joel Beakey for editing. Volume 3 of Theoretical Practical Theology, The Works of God and the Fall of Man, I believe available now from RHB. It's been out for a few months, and we'll pick it back up when new volumes come out into the future. But until then, if you want to keep the conversation going, you can get connected to our private chat server, our Discord server. All of our donors should receive an invitation to join in the server, and you can speak with and have conversations with other people, including many of our contributors and faculty members. If you'd like to get us in public space, you can find us at Reformed Forum on Twitter or send us an email at mail@reformedforum.org. But I certainly want to thank everyone for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.